Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. It's always good to get together with you. Hope you've had a great day so far and looking forward to a good conversation today. Ted Ross at the controls. Ted is just thinking, you know, up and down the talk radio dial, you know, on other stations, you'll probably find conversation about our guy, Jesse Ventura, you know.
He's back in the news, isn't
sure,
he?
Sure, willing to run with Donald Trump.
So. Yeah, he's willing to be his running mate if he gets to the run. That would be quite a circus,
you know,
I think.
We could talk about that, but we are going to talk about money and greed.
Let's do that instead.
But there is another part that we're going to bring into the conversation. The last part of the title of the book we're referencing is God. Money, greed, and God.
Important detail.
It is, yes. The subtitle is Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. So we are going to have a good conversation about economics and a wide variety of issues surrounding that, to get into, you know, resource use and, you know, fair trade, minimum wage, and all those kinds of things. And looking forward to bringing back to Connecting Faith a guest that we've talked to in the past and has a wide track record of education and instruction, and we just appreciate his insight. Dr. Jay Richards is serving now as executive editor of The Stream. He's also a professor of economics at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. area. Before that, he was served as a distinguished fellow at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. He also was at the Discovery Institute, formerly the director of the Discovery Institute Center on Wealth, Poverty, and Morality. And he's best-selling author, Infiltrated, was one of his books here a couple of years ago. He co-authored Indivisible, Restoring Faith, Family, and Freedom Before It's Too Late. Has written a number of articles and has a great deal of insight, not only on issues from kind of natural science, but economics is sort of his heart and passion. And also has a couple of years of seminary. So we've got a wide background of information to draw from. Jay Richards, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
No, the book Money, Greed, and God came out a few years ago, and it's from Harper One, but it really is a good summary of you know, the economic debates that we seem to encounter day by day. And I know that even in your background, you talk a little bit about, you know, growing up in Texas, but going to a university and sort of getting getting schooled in the liberal ideas right from the outset.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, I mean, I was in college in the 1980s, and so these were the issues that transfixed me. I got off my freshman year of college, and I would say kind of a formerly Christian liberal arts school would be the way to describe it. Found myself reading the Communist Manifesto in my freshman political science course and another book by an American socialist. So that by the end of my, you know, freshman year, I sort of thought, well, if you're a Christian, you probably ought to be a socialist. The socialists and Marx are talking about poverty. They're talking about human equality, all these things that we believe as Christians. And so I got all this stuff in my head. And it really wasn't until my senior year in college, as a result of continuing to read economics, that I sort of came around. I became convinced, just on purely economic grounds, that socialism just doesn't work. Whatever the branding is, it just doesn't actually pay off. It ends up, if anything, making people worse rather than better. So I had come around to basically a free market perspective, not the idea that free markets were a utopia, but just that they're the best of the live economic alternatives. Well, just about that time, you know, 1990, 91, the Soviet Union collapsed, and I honestly thought, okay, these debates have been settled. Let's talk about something else. And so I didn't spend any time on this for years. As you mentioned, Neil, I wrote on sort of theology science issues for years, but ended up back on Christian college campuses in the late 1990s and realized that the same bad ideas that I had in my mind about economics in the 1980s were alive and well in the minds of young college students, you know, 10 years after the Soviet Union collapsed. So I realized these are sort of perennial issues that we have to deal with as thoughtful people and as Christians. We've got to grapple with these issues, the nature of wealth and poverty, these questions about, you know, is capitalism based on greed? What's the best sort of economic alternative? And it's been gratifying. I mean, I wrote the book Money, Greed, and God really to grapple with these questions for people that aren't necessarily ever going to have an economics class or may have had a macroeconomics class and hated it. And so I wanted this to be a sort of thing that, you know, could be a companion book alongside an introductory economics textbook, but still be read even by people that might never read anything on economics.
Well, and I appreciate the fact that it's easy to read and easy to understand, and it covers, you know, some important areas, some important questions, which we want to get to. Money, Greed, and God is the title of the book we're talking about, and Jay Richards is the author. And maybe the first question you raise, does capitalism promote greed? That is, you know, one of the prevailing views, it seems like.
It is, and this is, I mean, I've noticed often, I ask people, okay, what's the thing that appears in your head when you hear the word capitalism? And for most people, it's that character on the Monopoly game, you know, it's sort of portly guy with a three-piece suit, and picture him with a monocle and a cigar. His name is actually Uncle Pennybags, but it was a caricature based on the American banker J.P. Morgan, and that's just what people think of. They think of a greedy guy, and this was, ironically, the perspective that was perpetuated by Ayn Rand, the famous novelist of the 20th century who defended capitalism, but she said that selfishness was a virtue. And so I think this is, in many ways, the most prevalent myth, as I argue, or fallacy about capitalism. And I think it's just important to look that, okay, yes, because humans are a fallen race, get two or three of us gathered together in a room somewhere and you're going to get greed, you're going to get avarice, you're going to get selfishness. The question is whether capitalism itself is based on greed, and there's no evidence of that. And in fact, if you go to a current or a formerly socialist country, you're not going to find less greed. You're not going to find less selfishness. And in fact, a comparison, a study a few years ago showed that Americans overwhelmingly are more charitable. In fact, the distant second would be the UK, and then the rest of the countries were way behind. So just as a percentage of our income, Americans actually give more of our income to charity than any other country. And so I just think on empirical grounds, there's no basis to this claim that the capitalism sort of fosters or creates greed. But the other thing is that greed is not even necessary for the capitalist system. What's necessary is essentially this kind of cycle of productivity in which people work, which people produce, and ideally they produce more than they consume. And then some of the money, at least, some of the capital that they produce is actually reinvested. And so really in a capitalist economy, people have to, at least a segment of the population, has to be really good at delayed gratification. We can't continually consume more than we produce. And so capitalism, the word in that is capital. The idea is that you need to build up capital. You need to build up wealth that's not being consumed that can then be reinvested. And so that's what you actually need to have a capitalist economy. And so, yes, of course, there's greed everywhere you look, but there's nothing essential to greed when you're thinking about capitalism. I think that's the key point people ought to realize.
And I guess, you know, one of the other, you know, main questions or the issues we hear about is, well, wealth is really, it's bad. It causes much of the world's suffering. And we hear a lot about the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. So to say about, talk about that disparity and, you know, is there a moral justification for this kind of growing disparity?
Well, there's several issues here, Neil. I mean, people often talk about the gap between the rich and poor, but really I think they're thinking about something else. For instance, there's a massive gap in wealth between Bill Gates and me, right? That's in fact, Bill Gates is worth probably 10 million times what I am in terms of net worth. Huge disparities. But there's no injustice there. It's not like Bill Gates is wealthy because of my income. It's not like I have somehow lost wealth because Bill Gates is much wealthier. And that's because wealth doesn't just get transferred around. It's not like there's a pot of gold out there in the economy, and if somebody gets too much, then that creates too little for everybody else. I mean, we know this when it comes to things like technology. Everybody knows, for instance, that the late Steve Jobs did not get wealthy stealing iPods from homeless people, right? He created wealth. He created value for himself and for others. And so when that's going on, the very mere fact that there's a gap between one group and another, I don't think it's morally significant. It's morally significant if someone gets wealthy by causing others to be poor. That's what happens with theft. That's what happens with genuine injustice. The mere presence of income inequality, I don't think it's not necessarily a big deal. And if you actually look at developed economies over the long haul, everybody ends up actually better off than they would have been. In fact, in the United States, even now, when we're not in all that great a shape economically, the bottom quintile, that is the bottom 20% of the population, lives better than the middle class in lots of less developed countries. And so I think, honestly, we should spend a heck of a lot less time focusing on the supposed gap between different groups of people in a population and just ask ourselves the question, how are people, in terms of their lives, compared to other types of economic systems, and how are the people at the bottom doing? And especially this, is it possible for people that are at the bottom, through hard work and diligence, to actually work their way out of that? That's called income mobility. And I think the question of income mobility is far more morally significant than this whole question about income inequality. What people are doing when they focus on inequalities, they're often assuming a so-called zero-sum game view of the economy. That is, they're assuming that if Peter gains a dollar, Paul must have lost a dollar. But that's not how things actually work in modern economies.
Well, you used the word reference pie, and I know you talked in the book about picture a cherry pie, but is the pie illustration not a good one when it comes to understanding wealth and maybe income gaps?
Yeah, it's actually a terrible metaphor, though it's always the first one that occurs to us. I mean, when people talk about somebody getting more than his fair share, the idea is it's just like you imagine the economy as a pie, and if you got a real pie that's, say, 12 inches in diameter, and you've got guests coming over, all you can do is slice it up. And so if you want to be equitable, you have to make, 8 or 12 equal slices, depending on how many guests there are. So that means if you want to eat a quarter of the pie, everybody else is going to get less. But notice the sort of key feature of the pie is that it's a fixed, finite amount. That makes sense with a pie. That doesn't make any sense when you're talking about a dynamic economy. Economies, general market economies, over the long term, actually grow. They get bigger, and so there's more wealth is created. Moreover, economies that trade with each other, you might imagine, for instance, that if the United States trades with Japan, that we can only get better off by Japan getting worse off. That's just simply not the way it works. We both end up benefiting because of some really basic and well-understood economic laws as a result of this activity. And so we've got to, very often we have to untrain our intuitions and retrain them to think in terms of real economic reality. Otherwise, we're constantly enslaved by these false and misleading mental pictures that we have about how we imagine the economy is supposed to work.
Well, I'm going to think more about pie during the break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk, we'll get into some more myths about capitalism. We'll talk about, the zero-sum game or the win-win, get into issues of maybe minimum wage and fair trade and globalization, all those kinds of things. Love to have you join the conversation, too, as we talk with Dr. Jay Richards, best-selling author. The book we're referencing is called Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Jay serves as executive editor of The Stream. He's also a professor of economics at the Catholic University in the Washington, D.C. area. He's joining us today on Connecting Faith. Your calls welcome at 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH. More in a moment. It's 19 past the hour. Talking to Jay Richards today. He's a best-selling author of the book we're referencing is one of his great books called Money, Greed, and God. He's written a number of them. He's The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. He served for a time at the Discovery Institute Center on Wealth, Poverty, and Morality. Also was a distinguished fellow at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, serving now as a professor of economics at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. area, and executive editor of The Stream. We'll talk a little bit more about what that is as well. The book Money, Greed, and God is subtitled Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. We've talked a little bit about the money and greed, Jay, but let's talk a little bit about God. Can a person follow Jesus, called to love one another and support capitalism?
Honestly, Neil, I think that's the key question. At least, of course, it's the key question for Christians, and that's that's really the question behind this book. It is really informed by my own struggle because, I believed a lot of the myths we've been talking about. I believe this greed myth, for instance. By the time I was a senior in college, I came around to the idea that, okay, if I compare the live economic alternatives, if you look at whatever you want to call it, capitalism or the free market or free enterprise. Look at socialism or democratic socialism like they have in Western Europe, or communism. The free enterprise is just the best of those economies, those economic options in terms of alleviating poverty and creating wealth. But I also had it in my mind that capitalism was based on greed. And as a result, I thought, well, you know, it's still ultimately incompatible with Christianity. It was only once I started reading people, thinkers like Michael Novak and George Gilder, that I came around to an understanding of this economic system that I think was better than some of the arguments even of its advocates. And so the way I would look at it is to say this, that don't imagine simplistically that you can, find an complete economic system from the text of Scripture. It's not like you're going to be able to go to the Gospels and prove that, you know, Jesus was a capitalist, to put it in really kind of simplistic ways. On the other hand, there are fundamental principles that we believe as Christians. We believe human beings are created in the image of God. We believe we're supposed to care about our fellow human beings. We ought to especially care about the least of these, the least of these among us, as Jesus says in Matthew 25. So the question is, based on what we know, what is the best economic system for allowing people the sort of freedom, religious freedom, economic freedom, for allowing people to create wealth, for allowing societies to alleviate widespread absolute poverty? These kinds of questions. Don't expect an economy to do everything, but for the things you want an economy to do, which of those is the best? And if you ask the question that way, I think you hands down will come to the conclusion that it's free enterprise. It's not perfect. It doesn't create the kingdom of God on earth. But if, as a Christian, you really care about your fellow human beings, then you ought to look at the real evidence. And the real evidence is that free economies, whatever problems they may have, do the best job of any of the live alternatives of bringing people out of poverty and creating economic wealth and economic value for wide numbers of people. And in fact, if you look historically, for most of human history, most people lived essentially a subsistence existence, which meant as long as they were lucky, as long as there wasn't a drought, they might be able to produce just enough wealth and just enough food to be able to get by. It's only in the last couple of centuries, as more and more economies have become free economies with rule of law and economic free trade and things like that, that you actually get a vast amount of wealth being produced so that we can, frankly, our society can afford for people to spend years in college, can afford to allow some people to write and to speak about these things. That's the result of a kind of wealth-creating economy that we all take for granted. And so I just think, asked in those ways, there's just no question what the best of the economic alternatives is.
The second chapter of the book is called What Would Jesus Do?, which, of course, is one of the questions we often ask ourselves. But, I guess that is a question. Would Jesus drive a BMW? Well, that was one of the conversations that happened in the early 2000s or so. And how do we interpret how Jesus responded to the poor and the needs around him?
Well, you've got to look at the full biblical picture, because what often happens in these discussions is that we sort of think of isolated verses. You know, Jesus said it's easier for, a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, for instance, which is perplexing to his disciples. You get Paul saying, what people think Paul says is that money is the root of all evil. In fact, he said the love of money is the root of all evil. I think what you got to look at is that Jesus had as much to say about money and wealth as he had to say about almost anything. So there's no doubt that this is a really important concern to God. It's an important concern to Christ. At the same time, look at all of his parables, such as the parable of the talents. People often will assume that, well, Jesus had nothing but bad things to say about money and wealth. But in fact, the parable of the talents, it presupposes that there's actually a responsible way of using wealth and of actually investing. Remember in the parable, the master gives his servants different amounts of wealth. He goes off and he's expecting them to do things with that wealth. He gets back and they report to him, and one has invested and made a bunch more. The other one has invested and done very well, but the third one, who had been given the least, actually just buried the wealth. He didn't do anything with it. And he's condemned and chastised for the master for doing that. Now, obviously, the parable is not sort of Jesus doing economics 101. It's about the kingdom of God, as we learn in the text itself. Nevertheless, here we see Jesus more or less presupposing that, that it's perfectly acceptable to engage in commerce, even to engage in investment. In fact, he treats shrewd investment and profit in a positive light here. And so I think very often what happens is that we isolate individual statements or individual parables rather than looking at the entire biblical witness. And I think when we do that, we get a much more subtle understanding of these things. And of course, it's true that wealth can be a danger because the more wealth a person has, the more power and the means they have at their disposal, and so the more means for doing both good things, but also the means for doing bad things. And so I think we should always take that as a warning. Nevertheless, it doesn't mean that somehow economic wealth is intrinsically a bad thing, because, of course, the only solution to economic poverty is economic wealth. And insofar as bone-grinding poverty is considered a bad thing in Scripture, we got to look at what the solution is. The solution is wealth creation.
In that passage, she chastises the one for at least not putting it in the bank and getting some interest. You address loans and interest rates. I mean, that's been an area where Christians have sort of wondered about as well. Should we be charging interest?
Well, in this one, of course, of all the dilemmas, this is the one that has been the most longstanding in the Christian tradition. In fact, if you look historically, for centuries, Christians were told that you shouldn't lend money at interest. I think the issue is complicated, but you have to sort of tease out separate issues. If you look at the biblical prohibitions against interest in the Old Testament, you notice that the Jews were prohibited from lending money at interest to each other, but it was acceptable for them to be able to lend money at interest to foreigners, to people outside the tribes of Israel. And clearly what that means is that even in the Old Testament, this wasn't considered an intrinsic evil. It wasn't something that's intrinsically bad to charge interest for money loan. What I think is going on there is you got to look at this sort of context. 11th or 12th century BC in ancient Israel, the tribes of Israel were essentially families. They're tribes. And so if one person was lending money to another person, it would probably be their brother or their cousin. And so that the way in which you interact with people that are family is going to be different from a way you interact with people in a commercial setting. And so I think what's going on there in the Old Testament is that Jews are essentially told, don't confuse family relationships for commercial relationships, but there's nothing itself wrong about lending at interest. The other thing is that money in ancient economies was really, in many ways, a different thing. Most wealth was tied up in land and things like that, and so if anybody had extra money, that is essentially coins, what they'd basically be doing is sitting on it. It's not like there was a modern banking system for them to invest. In a modern economy with modern banking systems, money does different things. Money's not fertile. Money's not sterile, rather. It's actually fertile. So if a bank lends you money, they're actually charging you for something because they're giving up the opportunity costs. They're giving up the other opportunities that they could use for the money. And they're also undertaking risk because they're risking the money itself. It might not get paid back. And so when they charge you interest, they're charging you for something of value. And so it makes sense that they would be able to charge interest. So,
well, Jay, let me jump in at the risk of missing the point. We're going to come back right after this hard break and talk more with Jay Richards about money, greed, and God. Free, that's what we want. Yeah, we're going to talk about that free money, because it's all free if it's the government's, right? It's all. But we're talking today about money, greed, and God, getting perspective today with Dr. Jay Richards, who serves now as executive editor of The Stream. He's also a professor of economics at the Catholic University in the Washington, D.C. area, best-selling author, Money, Greed, and God. One of his Infiltrated, a couple of years ago, came out. He's written a great deal on when he was with the Discovery Institute Center for Wealth, Poverty, and Morality. He wrote a lot about science and faith and philosophy. Got a great background and giving us some good insight today. And we're talking about capitalism. Does capitalism promote greed? Can a person follow Jesus' call to love others and also support capitalism? And was our recent economic crisis caused by flaws inherent to our free market system? You may have a question. You'd like to join the conversation. You're welcome to at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Or if it's more convenient, you want to drop us a note, you can use the email connect at myfaithradio.com and then go to the Connecting Faith show page. And there's an email link right there. You can send us your question. Jay, want to talk about some maybe issues that we're thinking about that have been in the news recently? Let's talk minimum wage. A lot of discussion about that. What's wrong with that concept, or how have we maybe missed what's really at work there?
Well, I think when we're talking about minimum wage, it's important to ask ourselves this question. What do we actually think is going to happen if we raise the minimum wage? Almost everyone that proposes it, whether they believe this or not, they're implying that by raising the minimum wage, we're going to somehow help people that are earning minimum wage. And so they imagine that, you know, if the minimum wage is, say, $7.50 and we raise it to $12 an hour, all those people getting minimum wage are just suddenly going to get a big raise. Nothing else is going to happen in the economy. Those people will all just be better off. The problem is this ignores some of the most basic facts about how the economy works. And everyone recognizes this if you sort of come up with an extreme example. So imagine that the Congress of the United States passed a law that said the federal minimum wage was going to be $300 an hour. So everyone, if they had a job, was going to have to be paid $300 an hour. Now, if you just think for a minute about what would happen in those circumstances, you'll figure out the nature of economic reality. Now, what would actually happen if the Congress passed that law? Would everybody be rich suddenly? Everybody would be earning, you know, at least $300 an hour, and the value of dollars would be the same as it was the day before? Well, no. What would happen is that people whose labor is worth less than $300 an hour would cease to have a legal job. And so the problem with the minimum wage is it fails to recognize what prices actually do in a market economy. What a price is in a market economy is it essentially a little piece of information that reflects the underlying supply and demand for whatever that is. And so every one of us, depending on what our skills are, where we live, what jobs are available, our labor is going to be worth a certain amount. The value of our labor isn't going to change just because a legal body dictates what employers can pay. And so raising a minimum wage, what that's going to do is it's going to harm the people whose labor is worth the least in any economy. And so the very people who, you know, maybe they have absolutely no skills. There's always somebody in a large enough community in which the thing they need the most is they need the experience of a job. Their labor might be worth hardly anything, right? But they still need to get a job. They need to get connections. They need to get experience. When you raise the minimum wage, what you essentially do is you just chop off the bottom rungs of the economic ladder for those sorts of people. So you raise the minimum wage. Some people will keep their jobs. Some people who are just right on the cusp, maybe they're about to get a raise, they'll get minimum wage. But everything else is going to shift. So we know from studies that one thing the minimum wage does not do is actually help the people it's supposed to help. But in fact, the people that are immediately harmed whenever you raise the minimum wage are usually single teenage males and usually minorities. So the very group of people that you most want to empower to be able to get a job and get experience are the very ones that get cut off when you do this. This is just sort of basic economics. It's really supply and demand more than anything else.
Well, let's talk more about, you know, those that we want to help the most, because there's another, I guess, area we talk welfare in a moment. But let's talk fair trade first, because isn't that designed to help those that are in real need and make a difference?
It is. And so usually when people are talking about fair trade, they're imagining something like fair trade coffee. And so it's a complicated issue. And so people often don't know what that means. But if all it means is that, well, I like to buy stuff from companies that know something about their supply chain, that's fine. But very often, like let's say with fair trade coffee, what you have is you sort of set up a scheme in which you pay the coffee supplier well above whatever the market price is for that commodity. So in this case, coffee. And so very often you come up with some kind of arbitrary amount. You say, this is how much I would like these people to be able to make, these coffee farmers in Nicaragua. And so we're going to pay them that amount. And then what that does is it inflates the cost, of course, of the coffee all the way up, so that when you're at your local Starbucks and you want to buy fair trade coffee, it costs more than regular sort of free trade coffee, let's say. And that's because the price is going to reflect the fact that you're paying the supplier more. But again, it creates these weird sorts of distortions so that, of course, essentially you can imagine, so one farmer is being paid well above market price than the farmer next door. And so we're sort of arbitrarily selecting one set of farmers to pay above market price. The other thing is it does is it scrambles the economic signal. So what's happening in the global coffee market, for instance, is a lot of places are actually no longer the optimal place to sell coffee. In fact, we think a lot about Central American farmers, but in fact, a lot of coffee farms are moving now to places like Vietnam. And so what really ought to happen is that the market signals would signal to coffee farmers that there's probably something that they could grow that would allow them to do better. But if you happen to be in one of these artificial fair trade schemes, you actually won't realize that. And so at some point, the price disparity will get so large that people won't be really interested in buying fair trade coffee because it won't be 15% more. It'll be twice as much more. And that's when there's sort of the farmers end up having to pay the piper in the long run. And so I think if you're interested in charity, if you're actually interested in helping farmers in Central and South America, I think there are actually better ways of using your charitable dollars than buying fair trade coffee. It's not the worst thing in the world, but again, it fails to recognize these subtle economic signals.
Well, speaking of interested in charity, let's talk about maybe U.S. foreign aid. We send billions in foreign aid, but it's really only a small percentage of our budget. How should we look at maybe this way that we provide aid to needy countries?
Well, I think the main thing to say is that it just doesn't work. I mean, it's one thing to talk about private charity in which there's a personal connection between the one giving the charity and the one receiving. But in government-to-government foreign aid, this is a sort of creation of the 1950s and 1960s. The idea is that we would just simply sort of find the countries that are really poor, give their government billions of dollars of either loans or grants, and then somehow that was going to speed up their economic development. Whatever you think about that, you can look at the data, and it just does not work. There's never been a country that's managed to emerge from poverty simply because of government-to-government foreign aid. It's not how it happened in the United States. No developed country actually got rich this way. And the irony is there's actually a perverse incentive, because what we've discovered is that very often government-to-government foreign aid actually ends up funding the very leaders, the very dictators in many cases, that are causing the poverty in the first place. And that's the sort of irony, because you'll have countries that the main reason that country is poor is because of corrupt political leadership, and yet from large loans from the International Monetary Fund, they're actually able to be underwritten. They're sort of protected from the political situation on the ground, and so we actually ended up funding the people that are causing the misery of the people in the first place. And so this is not anything anybody wanted to have happen. But the reality is if the developing world countries are going to get rich, they're going to get prosperous, it's going to be the same ways that we got prosperous in the United States. It's not going to come by way of government-to-government foreign aid. It just doesn't work.
You know, you talk about corrupt leaders. I'm just thinking, is the capitalistic system, maybe any economic system, I mean, can it work without some sort of moral framework, without an understanding of maybe truthfulness, honesty, holding to contracts, those kinds of things?
No, it really can't. I mean, the nature of a market economy doesn't require that everyone be perfectly just and virtuous. But I would say for a market economy to work, a population has to be, well, at least minimally virtuous, in the sense that most people in the population are not stealing from each other, they're not frauding each other, they're not enslaving each other. You have to have a minimal level of virtue where it's most people most of the time are just going to tell the truth. And if you don't have that, it's very, very hard to get a market economy off the ground. And we often take it for granted, for instance, that we're willing to trust economic agents and companies that are at some distance from us. This is actually kind of hard to do in some countries. Many cultures have a very hard time developing it. We have a lot of what sociologists call non-kinship-based trust, and that itself is something that you really need to have to be able to have a healthy market economy. And that just sort of underscores the value of these cultural factors that are separate from the economy itself. But you need cultural institutions like churches and schools and voluntary organizations really to produce and to maintain a culture in which a free economy can flourish.
You know, speaking of churches and foundations, I want to get your perspective on that, because one of the issues you address in the book, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution, Not the Problem, is the big area of government welfare that's been in operation for over 50 years in our country. Why hasn't that worked well, and what are some of the underlying beliefs in that system?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that no one has ever been helped by government welfare, but I do think if you look at the amount of money that's been spent on it, it's clear that it hasn't done what was promised. When President Johnson in 1965 declared a war on poverty and implemented these great society programs, he claimed his goal was to completely eradicate poverty. And yet, if you look at the actual poverty rate in the United States, what was happening is it was going down consistently year after year from the 1940s into the 1960s, and it more or less stagnated in the mid-1960s. And I think the reason is that many of the forms of poverty that are designed to be alleviated actually get exacerbated by our welfare system. So very often, below a certain point, there's certain types of poverty that require local solutions. Local charities overwhelmingly tend to work much better. What happens when the federal government is in charge of these welfare policies is that you lose all sort of bonds of accountability. So do you just imagine a situation where you're in a local church congregation and one of your parishioners loses his job, and imagine that everybody's involved and your church has a ministry to help connect him with employers and maybe training and things like that. Well, all those connections of accountability have a particular social effect. Now, imagine instead if a person didn't have that local network, and he just started getting a check from Washington, D.C. Well, now he's sort of being maintained in his position, but he's also not getting the kind of social connections he'd need to actually get a job. And, in fact, he gets incentivized not to get a job because, in fact, he's going to lose that check. And so while I think all the government programs are well-meaning, the over 70 means-tested welfare programs that we now have at a federal level, I think, are overwhelmingly actually perpetuating the problem rather than solving it. It's a very difficult thing to know how to get out of. But as this and many other cases, we come up with solutions that are meant to help people, but because we don't think through the economic consequences of these things, we can actually end up doing more harm than good.
You know, some argue that, even if all the church-based charities and foundations gave away all their money, it still wouldn't be enough, that there is a need for the government to be subsidizing or undergirding. So how should the church step up, and, maybe how do we work together? Should we be working together with the government?
Well, I certainly think that the church and the government have a role to play, but I think the government's primary role in these situations is to create the conditions in which prosperity can take place. The government just is simply not the entity that does a good job of actually creating wealth. It's not where the wealth is created. A government, when it's working properly, establishes the conditions where the private sector can create wealth. And certainly it's true that you couldn't, if you right now bundled together private charity, could not possibly equate, for instance, all the federal wealth transfers. But that's not what we're talking about, because, of course, if that part of the government was slowly pared down and the private sector stepped up, then those things would slowly become a part of the private rather than the public sector. So I think many of the analyses that say, well, the church has to be involved, or the government has to be involved because the church and charities don't have enough money, it assumes a sort of static situation in which the other parts of society don't take place. It'd be foolish to cut off all these programs starting tomorrow. That would be disastrous. But I do think there's a huge amount of room for reform in which many things that are being handled by the federal government could be devolved to the state and local and private organizations. And I frankly think people would be a heck of a lot better off if we do that.
Talking today with Jay Richards. Dr. Jay Richards has served in a number of capacities as a distinguished fellow at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. He was also director of the Discovery Institute Center on Wealth, Poverty, and Morality. He's currently a professor of economics at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. area, and executive editor of The Stream. Best-selling author, a number of books, including Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. That's the book we're referencing today. We're going to talk more about the conditions to create wealth, a bit about that. Is wealth a good thing? We'll get to that and more. And take your questions at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Past the hour, talking today with Jay Richards. Dr. Jay Richards serves as executive editor of The Stream, a professor of economics at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. area, best-selling author. The book we're referencing is one of his great works called Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Been getting some great insight on a variety of elements of our economic system. And you mentioned, Jay, before the break, we were talking about the government does a great job of providing for the conditions to create wealth. What are those conditions? What should that look like?
It's the most important single condition, Neil, for a society to be able to have economic freedom is actually the condition of the rule of law. People often say, when I'm talking about, you know, free economies or economic freedom or free enterprise, they imagine that means everybody getting to do what they want to do. But that's not actually a free market. That's anarchy. And if you want to know what that looks like, read the book Lord of the Flies by William Golding. A bunch of schoolboys, there's a plane crash on an island, and all the boys survive, and the adults die. And what happens after a few weeks is that the big, mean kids lord it over and enslave the weak kids. That's the law of the jungle. That is not economic freedom. To have a system of free exchange, you actually have to have the rule of law. You have to have consistent enforcement of laws. People aren't allowed to steal from each other, not allowed to kill each other and defraud each other. You have to have property laws where people's private property is protected and respected and defended by the state if necessary. So that's all these things that the government actually absolutely has to do. So when people say, well, if the government should just completely get out of everything, I think that's misguided. No, the government has an important job to do, but it is involved in sort of essentially establishing the conditions in which free exchange can take place. And once that happens, then all the things we take for granted every time when we go to the grocery store, right? You don't have to buy groceries from the grocer, but because of the law, you can't steal from him and he can't steal from you. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to provide groceries and services and to do it better than his competitors. So he's constantly thinking about how do I serve my customers. That's a system of free exchange. And so if you leave with groceries after you've gone to the grocery store, that only happens because you wanted the groceries more than you wanted the money you were willing to pay, and the grocer wanted the money more than the groceries, right? So that's a win-win exchange in which you both are better off as a result. Well, you can only have that for large numbers of people if you have a consistently enforced rule of law, and that's absolutely the core competence of the government. It's just that beyond that, there's a point at which government intrusion and government meddling, the costs exceed the benefits. And so when people are thinking about illogical regulations that the government often implements, they're often thinking about things in which the government's doing something it's just not competent to do, so that the costs vastly exceed the benefits of that activity. And so I think it's important to recognize that balance. You want a government that can enforce the rule of law, but you don't want it to be so large and so intrusive that it actually begins to violate the rule of law. And that, at least in the sort of original ideal of the American experiment, that was the idea of limited government, actual government doing what it's supposed to do, but nevertheless limited government.
Now, it's one thing to sort of use an illustration about groceries, but I guess let's think about consumer goods, because I guess, you know, maybe one of the arguments is that capitalism leads to this consumerist culture, and that, you know, we end up just getting more and more, and at the same time, resources get less and less. So talk about, you know, does capitalism promote consumerism?
Well, I think that is really a serious question, and there's no doubt that consumerism is a problem. But I wouldn't locate consumerism in an economic system. I would locate it, frankly, in the human heart, because it's not like, as far as I can see, I've not seen any evidence that people, for instance, are more greedy now than they were 50 or 100 years ago. I just think that what has happened is that as society has become more secularized, as the materialist worldview has started to permeate our lives in so many different ways, people start looking for false gods. And unfortunately, one of the false gods that you have, if you're not worshiping the real God, you've got a God-shaped void in your heart, and so you're going to look for something. And so for some people, if you live in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of people will substitute nature. They'll say, well, maybe nature can substitute for God. In the 1980s, in the New Age movement, people were trying to substitute themselves for God, you know. But the one that's probably most pervasive is stuff. We want to fill the spiritual void in our lives with more and more acquisitions of things. And that's as much a form of idolatry and sin as anything else. But I don't think anything like that is intrinsic to the market economy. And in fact, as I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, a real vibrant market economy long term requires people not to consume more than they produce. We have to both be hardworking and wealth producing. And yes, of course, we're going to consume some of that. But we also, the cycle to work long term requires that we also save and invest. Without that cycle of producing, saving, and investing, the system ultimately breaks down. So I would argue that at least long term, consumerism is actually hostile to capitalism rather than a part of it.
There's, of course, a great push these days about resources, that we're consuming too many resources. And that, again, it goes back to the sort of that cherry pie example, right? There's only a limited amount. Talk about our natural resources.
Yeah, and this is, again, it's one of these intuitive things. And the way I usually, when I'm talking about it, I wake people up is by saying, we will never run out of oil. And people think, that's crazy. What do you mean? Of course we're going to run out of oil. If we keep using it at this rate, there's a finite supply, and we'll eventually use it up. Yes, that's true, but that's not ever going to happen. And the reason is because of basic economics. If oil ever actually really gets scarce, what will happen is that supply and demand kicks in. So long before we actually use up the last drop of oil, if we kept using it at the same rate we're using it now, it would become more and more expensive to acquire the next gallon, and the price would go up. If this happened right now, for instance, if gasoline, or if oil rather, crude oil, were about $300 a gallon or $300 a barrel, we'd quickly be using alternative sources of energy because they would be more economical. The reason that's not happening right now is because for most uses, fossil fuels are actually very inexpensive, and they're much more robust in terms of the energy that they supply. And so the thing we're worrying about with fossil fuels now is precisely the same thing that people in the West worried about when wood was the primary source of fuel. In fact, there was a time in England's history when most of the forest almost got stripped, but as wood got more scarce, the price went up and people discovered coal and figured out they could use coal. Then immediately people started worrying about using up all of coal. Long before we ran out of coal, people started using regular other kinds of fossil fuel. And I would argue that if we ever actually did get to a point where it was scarce, basic laws of economics would kick in, the price would go up, human ingenuity and scarcity would work together, and we'd find another source of resources. And so I think when we're thinking about these things, don't just think about natural resources as, you know, a pot of stuff in the ground. Picture it in terms of human ingenuity, in terms of the laws of economics, and I think there's every reason to think that, look, just as has happened in the past, so in the future, if a resource actually gets scarce, the price is going to go up, and that itself will cause us to transfer to another source of energy resource.
Now, we've got just a couple minutes left, and we could, you know, talk about human ingenuity, but maybe just to turn that further to say that, you know, God is the one who gives us the ability to produce wealth, and just maybe a concluding comment about how we, you know, it's not all up to us, but God is a key part of this conversation today about, you know, economic systems.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's something we believe as Christians, that the economists know that human beings can create wealth. We can create value. What they don't know, and that what we know as Christians, is that human beings are made in the image and likeness of the creative God. So as Thomas Aquinas, a great medieval theologian, said, he said, God grants to creatures the dignity of causality, and he gives to human beings the dignity of creativity. God creates sand, but he leaves it to us to create things like fiber optic cables and computer chips. And so if you really want to think about economics, the first thing you want to do is get your view of the human person right. See us not just as consumers, but also as creators, as producers, made in the image of God and participating in the creativity that God has given us. That's the view of the human person you want when you're thinking about economics.
Co-creators with God, and who provides for us daily our needs. And we're grateful for the good conversation we've had today with Jay Richards, Dr. Jay Richards, executive editor of The Stream. It's stream.org, right?
That's right, stream.org.
Stream.org. Check out his writings. He writes regularly there. And in his free time, he's also a professor of economics at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., best-selling author. The book we've been referencing, Money, Greed, and God, is published from Harper One. Jay, always good to visit with you. Thanks for your great insight and the information that we gleaned today.
My pleasure.
If you missed part of today's program, I want to encourage you to check it out, the podcast. It gets posted after the show, and you can hear it, pass it on to a friend. Go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page for the audio archives. It's myfaithradio.com.